Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The climate change talks in Copenhagen are in their hard home stretch now. The spotlight has been bright. Everybody says they want to save the world, but who moves first and who will pay? In the streets this weekend, protesters called for action, for real commitments.
We're here to give a message to the politicians of the world, not just to keep talking, but actually to decide something. We think that the time now for binding legal resolutions is pressing.
This hour, On Point, the tensions, the national interest, the global stakes, and the heart of negotiations in Copenhagen. You can join the conversation. What's your hope, your fear for the summit in Copenhagen? Who should lead, and will the world act together? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Denmark and Copenhagen is Jeffrey Ball, environmental editor and columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Jeffrey, thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be with you.
So your headline today is, it's boiling down to the U.S. versus China. Tell us how, why?
Well, the why is that the U.S. and China are the world's two biggest emitters. Together, they account for about 40% of global greenhouse gas emissions. And the how is that essentially the two of them are fighting between each other over which of them ought to be required to do more and how each of them ought to be required to do something. This is representative of a much broader fissure between essentially rich countries on the one hand and poor countries on the other, that is developed and developing countries, over who should be required to do what. I mean, at the end of the day, this is an environmental conference in name, but it's an economic conference in fact.
We've got one more week, 110 heads of state headed to Copenhagen by the end of this week, including Barack Obama. Is it clear that Copenhagen will be, by however defined, a success? Could it end in failure?
Well, it's a question, again, of how one defines success or failure. If you look over the past few months, it's been interesting. Both the United Nations and various national officials across the world have essentially been dialing down expectations for Copenhagen. There was initially some expectation that Copenhagen might produce what's essentially a treaty obligating various large emitters, whether developing or developed, to reduce their emissions by specific percentages over time. It's clear that Copenhagen is not going to produce anything near that specific. I think that it probably will produce some sort of a declaration, because for it not to produce some sort of a broad declaration would just produce too much egg on the face of everyone who's here. I think the real question is not whether it produces some sort of verbiage, but what that verbiage says. And it's likely that it will be very, very broad, some sort of expression of a move toward increased commitment by large emitters over time, and perhaps an expression of willingness on the part of rich countries to increase the amount of money that they're providing to poorer countries over time to help those developing countries pay for a shift toward cleaner energy development. But what it's very unlikely to say is how that cost is going to be apportioned, that is, who's going to pay and by when, and which countries might agree to exactly what sort of cuts in emissions and by when. All those details are likely to be left unresolved, and that means that Copenhagen will just sort of continue the very difficult questions that it started with, and will push those down the line, and there will be more negotiating conferences to try to resolve them. But at the end of the day, the fundamental economic questions are going to remain.
But Jeffrey, the fallback position after it became clear that no treaty was likely to emerge from Copenhagen was at least some kind of basis for a binding agreement in 2010. 2010 starts in just a couple of weeks. Of course, there'll be verbiage, but there must be some minimal bar cleared to consider Copenhagen a success. How are people seeing that?
Well, again, the existing international treaty called the Kyoto Protocol expires in 2012, so there is something in effect for a few more years. But I don't think anyone thinks that that Copenhagen is going to produce a binding agreement that's going to have numbers in it. And so, again, as I said, the question is going to be to what degree this is going to get resolved, sort of in a year's time or 6 months' time. But it's pretty clear that, that there's not a lot of movement towards specific agreement now. Now, again, we should say too that, you know, there are many days left here, and it's possible that, that something could budge. But if one listens to the rhetoric is arguably getting more entrenched, not less.
China has been saying, one of the representatives there saying the United States needs to do some deep soul searching. You quote the China's vice foreign minister, He Yafei, speaking very colorfully on Friday about rich nations and global warming. What did he say? What was the metaphor he used?
Well, the metaphor that he used was of a group of people who go out to dinner, of wealthy people who go out to dinner at a nice restaurant and invite, and at the end of the dinner, a poorer person comes along and sits down and has dessert with the table. And then at the end of the dinner, the check comes, and the rich people who had dinner ask the poorer person to pay not just for his dessert, but for the whole meal, as if he had been there for the whole time. And the reason that the metaphor he thought applied is that in his construction, essentially China is the dessert eater. That the bulk of emissions historically have come from developing countries, and it's unfair in his mind the bulk of emissions have come from developed countries, rich mm-hmm. countries, and mm-hmm. he would argue that it's unfair of those countries now to say that it's incumbent on developing countries who over time have not emitted the bulk of greenhouse gas emissions to essentially have to shoulder the financial burden for that cleanup. Now, the reality against which all this is happening is that virtually everyone who studies emissions projects that essentially all of the growth in global greenhouse gas emissions over the next few decades are going to come from the developing world, half of them from China alone. So, what China does here is extremely important to the trajectory of emissions, which gets back to the question. And China is arguing that in order for China to do more, the U.S. ought to do more. And again, essentially, what we've got here is deadlock over global economic competition. There's a concern on the part of domestic industry in both countries that neither of them wants to be hobbled by what they regard as an increased energy tax. In their competitiveness with their rivals in the other country.
Jeffrey Ball with the Wall Street Journal in Copenhagen at the Copenhagen Climate Conference. Jeffrey, thank you very much for being with us.
Sure, nice to be with you.
Joining us now from Copenhagen is Michael Levy, Senior Fellow for Energy and the Environment and Director of the Program on Energy Security and Climate Change at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's been writing a lot about negotiations in Copenhagen. Michael Levy, thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you.
So as I understand it, I mean, the U.S. is essentially, the Obama administration is saying the U.S. will cut its emissions in the next decade or so back by 17% or in that area from 2005 levels and 80% back by 2050, by mid-century. China is saying it will make its industry, its economy, less emission intensive in something like that same period of time. But do we have a deadlock here? And if there is, where is the deadlock, Michael?
Everyone's focused on the numbers, and the numbers matter. But where I think the real deadlock lies right now between us and getting something really workable by the end of the week is in things that don't have to do with those numbers. The deadlock is in two key areas. The first is on whether countries' pledges will be binding internationally. The United States expects to make its pledge legally binding internationally, but developing countries have so far refused to do the same. And we know from the Kyoto Protocol experience that if we have that legal asymmetry, a deal isn't going to fly in the U.S. Senate. The second related, but not exactly the same issue, is something that negotiators call measurement reporting and verification, or MRV. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's transparency. Are China, is India going to step up and say, not only are we taking steps, but we're going to open the books in some respectful way, but we're going to open the books so that you can verify that we are taking these steps that we say we're taking, and vice versa. The United States would have to open its books too. Again, the U.S. wants to see broad measurement reporting and verification, whereas these other countries don't appear willing to do that. Now, a lot of the talk will be about numbers because that's easiest for people to understand. But my sense is that in the end, we could come to an agreement on that. You can change the numbers later once you've got a framework, but it's much harder to alter that framework, that legal framework, that framework for transparency that can be an enduring result of the meeting.
Michael, a basic question. If everybody did commit to and follow through on what they're talking about here, industrialized nations trimming emissions by 15% to 20% over the next, from 05 levels over the next decade, 80% by mid-century, China dialing its emissions intensity significantly back, 40% or 50%, would that be enough, do scientists there say at least, to address the climate change people are worried about?
It's difficult to square those numbers with the demands that scientists have put out there on climate change. But it's important to remember a couple things. Firstly, what matters is the total emissions over time. So what we have between now and 2020 doesn't necessarily seal our fate. What matters is that we can have very deep cuts over the long term. And the way that translates into what we do now between now and 2020 is we need to make sure that we take steps now that start to bend the curve, that make it economically feasible to make those deeper cuts over the long term, that help us deploy technology so that we can drive down their costs and do much more widespread diffusion over the 30 years plus after that. So right now, no, we don't necessarily set ourselves up to be following through properly over the 30 years after that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the home stretch in Copenhagen and what may be achieved on climate change. We're looking at the tensions, the national interests, the global stakes. Here's Archbishop, South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu in Copenhagen speaking out yesterday on the need for action.
The world is waiting for a proper deal here, and we don't have time. And we have only this one world, you know. If it goes, we're all done.
Desmond Tutu, yesterday, 100,000 maybe on the streets in Copenhagen. Lots of delegates hard at work. A walkout reported by developing and poor nations today. We'll see where that goes. We've been joined from Copenhagen by Michael Levy with the Council on Foreign Relations, Senior Fellow for Energy and the Environment there. Also from Copenhagen with us now is Fung An, Executive Director of the Innovation Center for Energy and Transportation. It's a climate think tank based in Los Angeles and Beijing. He's a leading architect of China's existing fuel economy regulations. He's at the center of a new partnership to reduce greenhouse gases made between the state of California and Jiangsu Province, a hub for solar panel manufacturing in China. Fung An, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you for having me.
The Chinese have been very tough on the United States, saying that the United States needs to do some big soul searching. But the word in the U.S. is if China doesn't make some bigger concessions here, we may have a failure in Copenhagen. How do you see the standoff?
Yeah, I think this is the starting point, but I think this week, I think some kind of agreement, I'm optimistic about some kind of agreement will be reached, because it's hard to imagine when all the top leaders gathered, in the next few days. So, I think it's going to be a losing face from part of China to not reach some kind of agreement, because China does not want to view themselves to be a roadblocker for the treaty. So if the agreement will not be reached, that will not be a fault of Chinese government.
On the other hand, China has been very tough in its language in the last week. Michael Levy in Copenhagen, if you can, kind of take us down to the nub of what the world is looking at in Copenhagen this week. Nobody wants to walk away empty-handed or with empty words. Starting with the U.S. and China, if they're to find some kind of what's the gap that needs to be closed there, I guess, if they're to find some kind of mutual agreement, Michael?
Well, from a U.S. perspective, there are several pieces that are desired from China, but a smaller set that could be put in place to make a deal work. The United States would like stronger actions from China, but I suspect that they would be willing to do a deal on the basis of the recent Chinese offer to cut its emissions intensity by 40 to 45% by 2020, in part because they think that China might revise its position later and do more. But there are two other issues where they are going, I think, to hold a very tough line on China. The first is on making sure that any Chinese commitment is legally similar to the U.S. one, so either they both take binding commitments or they both don't. And the other is that there be transparency measures in place for China's efforts. From the Chinese side, it's a little bit more opaque. There isn't as open of a political system, so while we hear the government pronouncements, we don't necessarily know what the bottom lines are. And the big question, I think, will be for China in whether it can come to a deal with the United States is, first, does it hold that line on the numbers it's asking for from the United States? It says it wants deeper cuts. I think that, like the United States, China would not scuttle a deal by demanding deeper cuts. But again, that transparency issue is critical. Transparency is not a natural thing for China. The Chinese government is not particularly transparent. That's fairly integral to its way of doing business. And having to open its books to international scrutiny is a very difficult step to take. So whether we can resolve that transparency issue, I think, is the heart of whether we get a successful deal.
Feng An in Copenhagen, let me come to you on that. First, on these two issues of a binding agreement and transparency, each side may not be perfectly happy with the other's offer of the numbers, what they're willing to do. But would China be willing to make its commitment legally binding? And what about transparency, letting the world come in to look at exactly what's going on with emissions?
I think there's a word called MRV, which is measurable, reportable, and verifiable. You know, I'd say
yes.
That is the core of transparency. You know, I think if you read the Chinese lines, you know, China is not really against the whole idea of MRV, because China did say that, you know, this emission target is legally binding, you know, domestically. So it's going to be written into the, you know, Chinese, you know, 5 years plan. It's going to be in a law. But China did say that, you know, they do not want to, China is concerned of the trade retaliation, associated with the MRV. China does not want to, committed, international law, under MRV. So there's also China has been accusing, some of the, developed countries. They do not live up their commitment, because if you read the Kyoto treaties, many countries, signed on Kyoto Treaty, they did not meet the Kyoto, emission cut target. So China is saying that, some countries, they didn't live up their own promise. So why did you ask us to, to keep up our, commitment one yourself, another make a, legally,
right,
commitment. So I think. Go ahead.
Let me ask you, if I may, it seemed last week that China might be asking the United States to pay it, billions of dollars to take these steps on carbon emissions. The American negotiator said, there's no way to we were going to see public monies from the United States going to China. Does China want the U.S. to pay it to make changes in its emissions policy?
Yeah.
Yes.
Actually, Chinese side, they did not really ask money for its own behalf, because China is making this voluntary emission target, without any, commitment or funding from, U.S. or Europe. So China actually, clarified that China does not, there's no precondition for China to make that commitment of 40 to 45% intensity reduction.
And Michael Levy, when we have President Obama and the Chinese leader both in town later this week, what do you think? Will this gap be closed so that people can say we've done it or not?
Well, firstly, we've had some confusing signals from the Chinese on the question of money. On the one hand, it's clear that their domestic effort to do a 40 to 45% cut in emissions intensity does not appear to depend on foreign money. At the same time, it's what China's already doing, so it's not a surprise that it doesn't depend on foreign money. The question is, will they ask for money if they're going to do anything more? And a lot of people, including Chinese government researchers, think that they can do substantially more if the conditions are right. As far as the two presidents getting together to break the deadlock, they spent several days together in Beijing just a few weeks back. It's not clear that coming back together now, particularly with so many other leaders there, that they're going to find some new magical formula. And remember, just because the United States and China will sign off on something, this is a big meeting. It is a meeting with dozens of large players and with almost 200 countries participating altogether. So having them come to a resolution doesn't necessarily deliver you an agreement in any case.
Feng An, China does a lot of manufacturing of products that end up in the United States. Does it feel it's fair to be asked to cut back its emissions when it's become, in many ways, the world's factory? We've in some sense, moved our manufacturing to China, for better or worse.
Right. I think there's an estimation about 20 to 30% of the CO2 emissions from China actually was associated with the goods export to other countries. So there's an argument from China that it should be consumption, consumers should pay the price, not the production of CO2 emissions, because currently, the carbon treaty is based on the who produce, who pays. But I think some scholars believe that the more fair system is who consume, who pays. So there's an argument about to move the production-based CO2 accounting to consumption-based CO2 accounting. But this is so far removed from current framework of international treaty. I don't think it's going to get any traction. So this just makes matters more complicated.
Feng An in Copenhagen with the Innovation Center for Energy and Transportation. Thank you very much for being with us today, Feng An.
Yeah, thank you.
Let me get a call right here from Richard in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Richard, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom.
Hi.
I think what the Chinese are talking about is only a slight reduction in what's going to be over 30 or 40 years, a dramatic increase. In other words, they're saying, we're not going to run up the score nearly as much. We'll just beat you about 96-7 instead of 121-7.
It's true that emissions growth, a lot of emissions growth is planned there. They're saying that they'll have less of it than it might be otherwise.
Well, yeah, but I think the analysis here in the States by scientists is that the increase is such as to make our carbon emissions irrelevant at current levels.
Richard, let us pick it up. Michael Levy, how about it? I mean, China is still on a big growth arc, and it's not the only developing country on a big growth arc. So what does that mean about American efforts if there's going to be so much growth in emissions in spite of their effort to dial them back?
Look, Chinese emissions are going to continue to grow for at least another 10 years. So are Indian emissions, probably for longer. And those emissions can continue to grow while still being consistent with hitting the global environmental demand. But they can't continue to grow too much. We've got this peculiar debate in the United States where growth in Chinese emissions is bad and reduction in Chinese emissions from the current levels is good. Reduction from the current levels is not a practical thing in the coming decades, but curbing the growth to a substantially larger degree than China has already offered to do is possible and is necessary. And we need to focus in that in-between territory. If we simply make demands, and I should point out that the United States government is not making this demand, but if the American people make the demand that China reduce its absolute emissions while its economy, which has three or four times as many people as ours, continues to grow, we're not going to get anywhere.
Let's bring in another voice from Copenhagen, an environmentalist voice. Kim Carstensen is with us. He's leader of the Global Climate Initiative at the World Wildlife Fund. Kim Carstensen, thank you very much for joining us.
Hello. Hi, Tom.
So we're trying to get a sense in all these negotiations if Copenhagen is actually pushing towards something like an important answer to global climate change or not. You're an environmentalist. How do you see what's going on?
Well, I think right now we're entering the crunch time. We're entering the part of the process here in Copenhagen where we'll actually see whether or not ministers and heads of state who are coming into town these days, whether they will be able to cut through those issues that have been sort of marring the negotiations for a long time. There are big issues still unresolved, so the answer is still blowing in the wind. We don't know whether we're going to get there, but I think we have a good chance and better than we're going to get in a long time.
Does a best-case scenario out of Copenhagen at this point look like a reasonable basis for a global agreement that might actually seriously address climate change or not, given what might actually be achievable this week as a foundation?
I think a best-case scenario out of Copenhagen does indeed start a massive transformation of the world economy away from a fossil fuel-based economy towards a clean energy-based economy, creating new green jobs, creating new opportunities both in developed and in developing countries. I think we have a good chance of achieving that. I do not think we're going to get everything that I would love to see in an agreement. I don't think we're going to get the certainty that the agreement is going to be strong enough to keep us away from dangerous climate change, but I think we can make a good start.
Let's get a caller here from Detroit, Michigan. Amina, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was just calling in to just talk about the real need for the talks to continue. In the city of Detroit, there is really, really poor air quality and a lot of climate change and the climate justice issues. Children in the city have really, really high asthma rates, and I really kind of implore the developed countries to kind of take some of the actions that the developing countries are asking for so that they don't pull out and that the talks aren't suspended.
So bring it on. Bring on the change, and you need it right there in your neighborhood, Amina, and we hear that. And I thank you very much for your call. Michael Levy, there's an appetite, you know, right in Detroit where even so much manufacturing has been lost. Nevertheless, you know, Amina is living it and wants less pollution in her backyard.
Well, that's right. And steps we can take to deal with climate change can help deal with local pollution. We should be clear that this direct link that she lays out isn't really there, but she points to something very important. And when we look not just in the United States, but around the world, we want to see not countries focusing on steps that they don't want to take, but focusing on steps that line up with other existing objectives. In China, you have horrible local air pollution. You have energy security challenges. You have gross economic inefficiency. And not everything we do to deal with climate change will address those issues, but a lot of it can. And that needs to be the focus of the discussion. And I think we've had some success, especially over the last year or so, in focusing that on that, not just on focusing on the overall targets, but on the specific policies that will be put in place that can deliver on these other objectives at the same time, because that's what people want to see.
Kim Carstensen, there in Copenhagen, do you see this, the negotiations, the real hardball stuff, as foremost about saving the environment, or is it about, we heard earlier in this hour, that in many ways it's an economic competition, nations looking to position themselves economically for advantage?
I think some of the strongest voices we hear in the negotiations here are from the small island states and from the poorest countries in Africa. And I think those are very much motivated by an urge to get a certainty that for the small island states that they can survive as nations. I mean, they are strongly threatened by sea level rise, by increasing hurricanes and storms, by pollution of their drinking water with salt intrusion into it, etc. So they are at risk as nations, and they really are fighting at this meeting to be heard and to be seen as a factor in these negotiations. So it's not only the big guys, the US's, the European Union's, the China's and the India's of this world who determine what this is going to be. And we hear the same things coming out of Africa where people are really concerned with droughts, with floodings, with changes in rainfall patterns that will affect their food production. So these countries are coming out strongly in the talks right here.
Do you feel enough moral leverage coming from their witness to get the big industrial countries to move?
I think it does play a role. I think it has played a role already, I think, in the discussions that have been about securing some level of immediate funding coming after this meeting so that there will be funding for the poorest countries, for them to adapt to climate change, for them to protect their populations and protect their forests and their coral reefs and their other nature areas against the effects of climate change. And that money, I believe, is actually, it's not in the bag, but I think it's actually getting the money to the tune of possibly $10 billion per year coming from the rich countries to help the poorest countries actually deal with climate change much more than they've been able to so far.
Protests there in Copenhagen over the weekend, protesters demanding action on global climate change. We're looking at the home stretch in the big climate conference in Copenhagen this week and what may be achieved on climate change. looking at the tensions, the national interest, the global stakes there. Michael Levy joins us from Copenhagen. He's with the Council on Foreign Relations, been writing extensively about developments there. And Kim Carstensen is here, leader of the Global Climate Initiative of the World Wildlife Fund. He spoke of small island representatives there. Here's one, Selwyn Hart, telling the BBC that the survival of vulnerable developing countries is on the line.
We certainly do not believe that there is sufficient level of ambition in terms of reductions, emission reductions, or finance that would really satisfy the demands of the science.
110 heads of state headed for Copenhagen by the end of this week, including the heads of states of China and the United States. A walkout earlier today, at least briefly, by developing countries, saying that not enough has been done by the industrialized world to help them to step forward on climate. We've got a lot of questions here from listeners. Let's go to Richard in Omaha, Nebraska. Richard, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I would suggest that the most important thing is that the United States take responsibility for its historic role. The U.S. is responsible for 27% of the CO2 in the atmosphere. China is responsible for 8%. If the U.S. came out very strong and did what the Europeans would do, 40% reductions below 1990 levels, then China would be under enormous pressure. The problem is that our society just hasn't woken up to this problem and our responsibility.
That's a much bigger step, 40% below 1990. The U.S. is offering to get down 17% below 2005 by 2020. Michael Levy, how about it? Our caller in Omaha, Richard, says, U.S., act first, and the leverage on China and everyone else will be greater.
Firstly, everyone needs to act together. We can't wait for any key countries to become part of this. Second, let's be clear about what Europe is doing and how it compares to the United States. Europe has offered to cut its emissions by 20% below 1990 levels by 2020. Because of various things that have happened in Europe, partly because of policy, but in large part because of the collapse of Eastern Europe, because of Margaret Thatcher's decision to break the British coal unions, and because of low population growth, the ambition required to meet the European target over the next decade is roughly the same as the ambition required to meet the U.S. target. So there is not an enormous ambition gulf between the United States and Europe. Now, would a much deeper U.S. cut bring up China? Well, firstly, that cut is not going to happen in U.S. politics. So if the U.S. made a promise to that kind of cut at Copenhagen, it would actually backfire, would make action less likely, and we wouldn't get a 17% cut from 2005. We would get nothing. That's a lot worse environmentally. Secondly, China makes its decisions fundamentally based on direct Chinese interests in energy security, in pollution, in economic efficiency. And what we need to do, instead of showing that if we bloody ourselves more, they can too, is point the way towards steps they can take that are consistent with their national interests, but that also deeply reduce emissions. And like I mentioned before, Chinese government researchers have identified a host of those that would take them beyond what they're already pledging to do.
Kim Carstensen, as a Danish observer here, how do you see the United States' role? Of course, the U.S. was not part of the Kyoto Protocol. Now we're in Copenhagen. You hear our caller saying, U.S., do more. As a European, how do you look at the U.S. role in the lead-up to Copenhagen and in the 2 weeks there unfolding?
Well, it's absolutely necessary that the U.S. becomes part of a new international climate agreement, and luckily, we're in a much better position for that than we've ever been before. I mean, now there is legislation being discussed in the U.S. It's passed in the Congress, and I think
only the House, not the Senate. It's still a pretty big stumbling block.
That's a pretty big stumbling block, but still it's long further down the road than we've ever been before on this, and we have a president who really takes this seriously. I think the main thing that the U.S. can do is actually right now is, of course, come to these negotiations, and it's great that President Obama is coming. I hope that he will be convincing in talking about the real transformation of U.S. economy that he is envisaging, creating green jobs, creating a future for the U.S. where energy will be cleaner, where there'll be a lot of new opportunities opening up through taking long-term, serious and significant action on climate change. I would like to see more from the U.S. in terms of emission reductions. I would also like to see more from Europe, because I fully agree that Europe is not more ambitious in terms of the actions over the next 10 years. And I would like to see more from everybody, because that is what science says that we need in order to be sure that we can keep temperature rise below that danger threshold. threshold of 2 degrees.
2 degrees Celsius over 1800 levels, I guess. Kim Carstensen, you're with the World Wildlife Fund. I mean, Michael was saying earlier that what's being discussed to be done here actually wouldn't be enough to mediate what scientists say is the problem. But at least it would be a start, and we could come to it later. But, you know, some climate scientists say we could face abrupt climate change. It may not be many, many decades away. It could come sooner. I mean, in that sense, is Copenhagen ambitious enough, even at its best?
No, I don't think Copenhagen is ambitious enough, but the alternative is doing nothing. No, the alternative is getting Copenhagen to become as ambitious as we can get it, and then to make sure that when we take action, we make sure that that action actually pays off, both in terms of reducing emissions and in terms of creating clean, green jobs and in terms of getting clean energy and resolving these other issues that you also talked about before in terms of air pollution, etc. It's crucially important that people and governments begin to see much more clearly that the advantages of action and not just see it as something that is completely burdensome and very, very difficult. Because once we get that shift in mentality, which I think the U.S. is on its way to actually doing, then I think we can get somewhere.
Let's go to Stowe, Massachusetts, and Dave. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks for having such a great discussion. This is so important. I just want to say that I am really a bit disgusted and distressed at the disingenuous positions taken by the U.S. and China in particular. Both countries make valid points. The U.S. is historically responsible for the largest share of CO2 in the atmosphere, and China's soon going to be a big emitter.
It's the number one emitter now,
What's that?
It's the number one emitter now. U.S.
It's
now
the
number two.
It's the number one emitter now, but it isn't responsible for as much 27% historically versus 8% as the other caller said. But neither of these is an excuse not to take for inaction, given the gravity of this threat. Any country could unilaterally say we're going to meet commitments to reducing CO2 and we're going to refuse to trade with countries that don't meet them. Now, that may be considered protectionism in some circles, but this is a really serious threat. And I think, ultimately, the leaders don't really get that this is critical, and we have to mold the economic system to recognize the way the environment works. That's all there is to it.
But who's going to flex those muscles, Dave? I mean, China wants to trade. The U.S. needs to trade with China. We owe China a ton of money. I mean, who's in a singular position to sort of flex their muscles and say, listen, everybody, you know, I'm laying down the law here. Who can do that?
Well, I think that if the countries decided, you know, in this case, our Congress and in the U.S. and whatever the political decision-making process is in China, I'm not totally familiar with that. If it was serious enough, we would say this is how we're going to do it. You know, if you know, obviously we've got senators that are. I saw the lady senator from the South somewhere saying that it's going to cripple the economy if we meet the thing. But you know. The other side of it is if we're going to ruin the planet to be habitable for people, it doesn't matter what the economy is doing. I mean, we have to make the economy work, obviously.
Dave, we've got it, and let us pick that up. Michael Levy, I mean, it's interesting on a couple of levels, but one is when you look at these negotiations, there is no king of the hill here. There is no single nation that can lay down the law and say this is how it's going to be. Is there?
No, that's what makes this so difficult, and it's what makes it's what drives the fact that we're never going to have an international agreement that seals things up. And I think that Kim and I are roughly on the same page with this. Copenhagen can be a motivator. It can help drive action. But ultimately, what's going to matter are the steps that individual countries take to drive a transformation to clean energy. And Copenhagen can help that along. So can future international meetings. But it's never going to come up with the complete list of precise actions that we need to take. It's not going to come up with some automatic system of trade sanctions that will hurt those who don't take steps so much that they will then come back into the fold. I think things will be a little bit more ad hoc. What we need at the international level is that broad guidance and that framework so that we can get into a bit of a virtuous cycle amongst countries, one taking strong steps and another taking strong steps as a result, rather than this vicious cycle that we could get into with trade sanctions and recriminations like that.
Our caller was saying, you know, the Senate could back this up, but the fact is the U.S. Congress didn't come on board with Kyoto and the Senate hasn't come on board here. Barack Obama's coming to Copenhagen, but he doesn't have necessarily legislative backing for his proposal of a 17% reduction from 05 by 2020. Does that weaken his hand, Michael?
Absolutely, and this is far from a done deal in the United States. And it's very important that people keep that in mind. We keep talking about pushing up U.S. ambition, increasing U.S. commitment. We have to remember that if we get higher rhetorical ambition, higher ambition in Copenhagen at the expense of lower action in Congress, that's bad for the environment. The environment responds to action, not to declarations. So we need to be very careful about that. The president has a very fine line to travel. If he can come up with something in Copenhagen that looks positive back in Washington, that helps him pass legislation, then that's great. But he has to be very careful not to get the opposite outcome, where the result in Copenhagen makes it more difficult for him to follow through back home, because he's already got a pretty tough fight.
He sure does. Let's get a call from Davenport, Iowa. Chris. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Could one of these, could you guys talk a little bit about how some of the science is actually, they think some of the science that mankind is causing global climate change. There's other scientists that say that that's not true. And for every scientist or climatologist that says that it's man and his SUV causing this change, there's another scientist that says that's not necessarily true. The world is constantly changing. And now they have this climate gate. They found that people have been covering up the science that says that mankind is causing the global warming. I wonder if they could comment to that.
We absolutely will, Chris. Michael Levy, I'll come first to you on that. To just say, as a matter of record, everything I read, while there certainly are scientists who don't endorse it, I don't think it's, as Chris describes, you know, for everyone, there's another on the other side. It doesn't seem equally balanced at all anymore. But what about his point? And the controversy over emails that came out, you know, showing efforts to shape public opinion around climate change understanding?
Well, firstly, it's certainly not one-to-one. There are dissenters, as there always will be. But the bulk of the evidence does point toward very damaging effects if we continue along business as usual. There are some people who have behaved very badly as exposed in those emails, and I find it peculiar when people spend too much energy defending them. But the bottom line is that there is a vast scientific effort looking at these issues, analyzing them. Will there be some residual uncertainty? Yes, there always will be. And the question then becomes for us, what risk do we want to take? Do we want to take the risk of paying a small, definite cost, but possibly having very bad consequences? Or do we want to avoid paying that small cost of transforming our economy, but then as a result expose ourselves to huge potential downsides? If my house might burn down, I buy insurance. And I think we need to do the same thing here.
Let's get a call from Cookeville, Tennessee, and David. David, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. There seems to be a consensus from scientists that even if we were to reduce carbon emissions to zero now, that we would not be able to avoid catastrophic conditions, as well as the fact that there seems to be a fatalistic, consistent message that comes out. And there's a police song that I think Sting wrote that says, when the world is running down, make the best of what's still around. Is it possible that we've reached a point of fatalism here, and should we not be focusing some of our efforts on the challenges that the irrefutable climate change catastrophes are going to bring? Should we not be spending some money to solve the problems that we are facing that we can't stop?
Yep.
And I'll take your spot.
David, we've got it. Make the best of catastrophe. Kim Carstensen, first, to David's assertion, you know, even if carbon emissions were taken to zero, we'd still have a catastrophe here. Could you just respond factually to that?
Yeah, I mean, what we know is that temperatures have already risen by 0.7 to 0.8 degrees. They will inevitably, no matter whether we stop emitting to tomorrow or keep doing it, they will rise further, but they will not, at this point in time, rise beyond 2 degrees. So we're still below that level. And if we take significant and serious action now, it will indeed be possible to avoid the catastrophic impacts of climate change. That does not mean that climate change will not create problems. Climate change is already creating problems for people around the world, for people who get hit by increased levels of tropical storms, from people who get hit by sea level rise, et cetera, et cetera. And therefore, we need already now make sure that we prioritize helping people become able to adapt to climate change. And that needs to be a very high priority going out of this meeting in Copenhagen. And I think that in general terms, that understanding is there among politicians, both from the rich countries and from the poor countries, that adaptation needs to be a high priority. But it's not too late to combat dangerous climate change.
Michael Levy, we've just got a minute. Tell us what to listen for on Friday in the final statements out of Copenhagen to know whether it's, you know, sort of been muffed or made progress.
I think there are two sets of things to listen for. The first is, how comprehensive is an agreement? How much does it address some of the key issues, whether it's agreement on numbers, on legal form, on transparency measures? But the other is tone. How do the countries sound? What's their attitude toward each other, toward the future and dealing with this issue? Because I think that's what a lot of folks are going to be looking at. In the United States, people will be looking at the attitude of the Chinese. Is it positive? Is it constructive? Or is it blocking progress? And I suspect in China, they'll be looking at similar questions in the United States. So substance is critical, but given that we're not sealing up all the final elements here by any stretch, tone matters just as much.
We'll be watching for both as Copenhagen moves through these last days and toward its conclusion at the end of this week. That is not far now. 110 heads of state gathering. It should be some week. We're grateful to each of you for helping us get a bead on what's going on and what to look for as it goes toward a conclusion. Kim Carstensen with the World Wildlife Fund in Copenhagen. Mr. Carstensen, thank you very much for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
And Michael Levy, Senior Fellow for Energy and the Environment, Director of the Program on Energy Security and Climate Change at the Council on Foreign Relations, joining us also from Copenhagen. Michael, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.